All right. Buenas and half a day, todos hamzu. Today we have a very, very special episode of Fanatsu coming for everybody. And so, Spencerzu and Ratu are just getting everything set up. Lo, I am the producer for today's episode, Michael Lujan Bavacqua. But before we introduce today's episode featuring local Black Lives Matter voices, I want to just remind everybody about Fanatsu. Fanatsu is the official podcast for independent Guahan, and it is made possible because of those of you who view it, those of you who share it, those of you who appear on it. It is indigenous, it is an independent media, it is made possible through patrons, and it's interesting now because when we first started a Patreon for Fanatsu, like maybe 10 people on Guam knew what a Patreon was. So when you tried to ask your auntie, hey, can you sign up as a Patreon, they thought it was something like the Neo Catechumical Way or something like that. And then people were not interested. And some people were, but most people were not interested in signing up for something like that. But now Fanatsu happens every week, sometimes twice a week, because of the several dozen patrons that we have. We've got a nice solid crew that has supported us, and we appreciate it, especially during the lockdown. Those of you who kept up your support and your subscriptions, even as sort of things were getting grim economically, socially, politically, and so on. And so remember that if you sign up as a patron for Fanatsu, you get access to sort of the exclusive content. This stream, the main episodes are always free on Facebook nowadays, but you get access to close to 100 sort of secret podcasts, secret Guam history podcasts, radical reading podcasts. And so sign up for one of the tiers, and you can go and download all of those. I mean, if you aren't already sick of hearing my voice or seeing my face, that is. But I'm glad that you're not going to see my face or hear my voice much longer on this episode, because I'm about to hand it over to Nicole Quintanilla, who's going to be your host for today. And Sidus Masi Tatlu, Nu Hamzuna Tres Paresti, Kulalot Nyahogu Nicole. Esta.
Hey, welcome to the podcast, everybody. Today we are speaking with local Black and Chamorro people here on Guam who had participated in the Black Lives Matter movement. Just wanted to start by saying Happy Juneteenth. For those of you who are unaware or not familiar with Juneteenth, basically Juneteenth is the celebration of the official end, the real end of slavery. So slavery had quote unquote ended in 1863, but a lot of the slaves didn't know they were liberated or didn't know that they had got freedom until 1865, 2 years later on June 19. So that is why we celebrate Juneteenth, and such a coincidence that we happen to do this podcast. It happened perfectly that we happened to do the Black Lives Matter podcast here today on Juneteenth. So along with us today, we have two other members here of the Black and Chamorro community. You guys want to introduce yourselves?
Hafaday, my name is Talisa Kakis.
Hafaday, my name is Kiana Brown.
Okay, so we have these two beautiful ladies with us today. So these women here are part of the Black and Chamorro community. And in light of recent events with George Floyd and with everything happening across the world, and especially in America, we felt it important to kind of talk about these issues and talk about our experiences here on island and what we thought about everything going on in the world. So, Talisa, right? You were one of the women who started the Black Lives Matter protest at Chief Kapua, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so what prompted you to, how did you go about deciding we have to have this protest, we have to have it here on Guam? Why? Why here on Guam?
Well, one of my friends, Talani, she's not here right now, but she's the one who actually reached out to me through DMs and was asking if I ever thought about planning a protest here on island. And then it kind of just went from there, because we did see all over social media, Twitter especially, everything that was happening in the States, and mostly stuff that we weren't seeing on official news in the United States. So we were seeing the behind the scenes of like all the protests happening back there and police brutality firsthand on people who are peacefully protesting. And we thought that we did, since we were African-American and Chamorro too, we felt like with what we've experienced here in Guam, we can try and bring up the awareness that it does happen here too. Even if it's not police brutality, it is racism. And we just kind of wanted to spread awareness here as well.
Right. Okay. It's an awesome explanation. And the protest was so beautiful. There were hundreds of people lined up and all wearing masks, very safe.
Yeah.
And it was a very touching, very moving, very unifying event, right? And so I guess one of the frequently asked questions that that a lot of people are asking is, what even is Black Lives Matter, and why not all lives matter? What's the difference, and why are people protesting for Black Lives Matter?
Well, I think people are protesting, well, I was protesting for Black Lives Matter because it all started really with George Floyd and how he was killed with a knee to his neck, and all he did was supposedly give a fake $20 bill. And it all kind of rooted from there, how it wasn't justified and it wasn't fair. And there are other individuals, white males specifically, who do go and shoot up schools or churches, and they're apprehended very calmly by the police. And just for George Floyd to have his neck be kneeled on, just trying to get arrested and everything, and he wasn't even in custody at the police station yet, that was just really cruel to see. So that's kind of what did push us to try and show our solidarity with them.
Right. And I'd like to add to that, because I think that, you know, what happened with George Floyd isn't anything new, right? That's not the first time that a Black man or a Black person has died at the hands of police officers. But what was different this time was that it was televised, right? People were there with their cameras, and everyone was kind of forced to sit through those 9 minutes and watch that happen. And again, that wasn't the first time that it's been caught on camera. And a lot of people have been speculating, like, why now? Why did it take this particular moment to catalyze this movement again, to get people to start talking about Black Lives Matter? And I don't have the answer for that, but I know that, right, that's why a lot of people were standing out there. That's what motivated my family to stand out there with me, where before that was kind of something that was like a touchy subject, right? No one really wanted to confront that conversation because it's a difficult conversation to have. But yeah, I just wanted to point that out, that it's a long history, right? This isn't an isolated incident, and we see it happening every day.
Right, we definitely see it happening every day. And you're right, you know, maybe we don't see, you know, here on Guam, we don't see people being pinned down, you know, with the knee to their neck and dying right in front of us. But we do see racism every day here on Guam. It's a very, very real thing that a lot of people don't really register or don't really pick up on or necessarily think about on a regular basis, which isn't a luxury that a lot of people have, right? A lot of Black people have, right? We as Black people don't have the luxury to just go out and do whatever we want, especially in the States, you know, to just do whatever and go wherever and accidentally spend a $20 bill, or even like Breonna Taylor, and sleep in our bedrooms and defend ourselves when somebody tries to break in. You know, we don't have the luxury of being,
we don't have the luxury of ignoring that these things are happening, right? And I think that that's the big thing that a lot of people are starting to recognize now. It's like you guys both said, even though it's happening, people think that it's happening far away. We all know, based off of our own experiences, that racism is alive and well here, and anti-Black racism specifically, because we've all personally experienced that in our social circles here.
Right, for sure. Speaking of, right, growing up here on the island, we're all half Chamorro, half Black, right? So what are some of your experiences here on island as this unique hybrid of a person, this unique mixture of identities?
Man, Talisa, maybe you should start this one off.
All right. I was actually born and raised here in Guam, so I never really, I guess, saw a difference between me and other people because of how I was raised and growing up with the Chamorro culture. So I always thought, like, I'm just like them, everything like that. And I guess it started way before first grade, like pre-K, I would say. I did go to a private Christian school for my pre-K year. So I realized that there were a lot of people who were like me. And then when I did go to public school first grade, that's when I was like, wow, I'm the only person that looks this way. And other kids were starting to point out that my skin was darker, my hair was curlier. And I knew that there are obviously darker complected Chamorros, same complexion as me, even maybe darker, but it was obvious that I did look more Black than I did Chamorro. So growing up, I was teased. I was called the N-word, even with the hard E too. And it was just by kids whose parents or their surroundings didn't really educate them that there were different types of people in the world, that there wasn't just one race or one ethnicity. So growing up on Guam, I did experience racism at a very young age. And it was kind of like a slap in the face for me because in my family, I do have a lot of cousins and aunts and uncles who are also half Black and half Chamorro. So it's kind of like a norm in my family. But when I did go out into, I guess, the real world as like a 7-year-old and saw that there were people that were different and them pointing it out that I'm not from here or I'm not Chamorro because I don't look like a Chamorro, that's kind of what opened my eyes that it was here from a very young age.
Yeah, I think I had like similar experiences, right? A lot of the racism that I experienced growing up happened like in school. Sometimes it would happen in my family. So I guess I'll start there. I think, you know, growing up in a Chamorro family, a lot of what I experienced was this, them saying like, oh, you know, you're not Black, you're Chamorro because you don't look too dark, or you like Chamorro food, you don't like American food. So, you know, it's okay, you're Chamorro. Like kind of trying to push away my other heritage or, you know, my other family. And that was something that I personally struggled with a lot, not even in my immediate, like in my household, because in my household, my mom stressed to me that I needed to embrace both of my heritages. But it wasn't until I went to like my grandma's house or my Nina's house that I would start to hear that, like, no, you need to push that aside. And a lot of that was because what I think now was because, growing up, they were taught not to like Black people, or, you know, they were taught that Black people are a certain way. And so maybe it was just easier for them to teach me to push that away instead of confront it and have like those difficult conversations. And then you go to school and like you said, right, there are kids who kind of grow up in similar households who are not really educated about how many different people there are in the world. And then they see my hair, which doesn't look like their hair. And they start making comments about that. I've also been called the N-word multiple times. I've been told to go back where I came from. my oldest sister is Chamorro, right? Just full Chamorro. And people would always question us, like, how are you guys sisters? I don't understand. You know, are you adopted? So like there's so much having to negotiate that kind of dialogue that we hear like in our social spaces. And it wasn't until I think I got older that I began to process that in a way that was constructive, right? Because I think the tendency is you hear your family telling you not to be Black, so you kind of want to go with the grain, go with what they're saying and kind of push that aside. But yeah, I think that people don't realize that happens. And that there are a lot of Black Chamorro people in the community too, right? It's like you said, even in my family, there's a lot of half Black, half Chamorro, half Dominican, right? So I grew up seeing people who look like me, but then we weren't really like encouraged to embrace our other heritage.
Wow, that's so interesting hearing, you know, your stories, because I don't necessarily talk to or, you know, have a lot of Black Chamorro friends, you know. I went to high school with Kiana, but we weren't the same grade. We didn't, you know, talk to each other. So like we kind of just like totally drove by each other and missed each other. But, you know, it's definitely interesting to see how we all have like that similar shared experiences, you know, like looking at, so I'm the only half Black, half Chamorro person in my family, like in my whole family. And I was kind of like a surprise out of nowhere kind of kid. So, you know, I don't have any connection to my Black side. And so, you know, it's like kind of strange having been brought up not Black, you know, like everything that all that I've experienced was very Chamorro, you know, but I had darker skin than all my cousins and I had curlier hair than all my cousins. And I just like, it was very, very obvious that I was not like the rest of my family, you know, and it kind of like, I really stuck out. And so I kind of like had that whole like identity crisis, like who am I? How come I don't look like them? How come I'm different, you know? And then I as I grew older, I realized because I'm Black, and you know, and so when I came to this realization, it kind of just blew my mind, right? And so I definitely felt, you know, a lot of what you guys were feeling, a lot of what you guys were experiencing. We have a couple questions coming in. So let's try and address some of these. One person says, I keep hearing anti-Blackness being talked about, but I don't understand what that means. Can someone explain? So any takers?
I guess because I've been using it, I'll explain as best as I can. But anti-Blackness, when people are talking about anti-Black racism, they're talking specifically about the racism that the African-American or the even Afro-Black people have experienced due to the historical like way that they've been portrayed, you know, in media, the way that people have stereotyped, the way that those stereotypes have been internalized, the way that controls how other people interact with Black people. So that's what I think about when I use that phrase, anti-Black racism. Because I think Talisa mentioned like, you know, it's not like everyone here on Guam is like super white, right? We're all kind of like different shades of brown.
Yes.
Yeah, but there's a specific kind of hate that's geared towards the Black community because of that history. And yeah, so that's what I mean when I say anti-Black racism. And that's such a big question. And how I defined it is definitely not the only way to define it, but hopefully that's a start.
Right, you know, and I feel like a lot of times in not just our community here on Guam, but, you know, in the States, everywhere, it's become so commonplace, so usual for this anti-Black rhetoric to seep into everyday life. You know, like I'll walk down the hallway and, you know, and I'm a teacher and I'll walk down the hallway and I'll hear the N-word being thrown left and right. And these kids think it's cool. They think it's funny without realizing like what it really means. What are they really even saying? Do they know what they're saying? You know, it's such a simple thing for them to throw around, you know, and it's such a heavy thing, a heavy word that they don't realize the weight of it.
Even that just reminds me, like, even something as simple as, you know, I think you guys have probably heard this too, like, oh, you better put a shirt on, you're gonna get so black, right? Out there when yeah. people are in the sun, oh yeah. man, you look so black. And the way that that's said, it's like there's such a negative Yeah, there's such a negative weight to that word. And that's all part of what you said, like, right, these everyday things that people say that they don't realize, you know, where it's rooted in or where it's coming from. Like, mm-hmm. Black is been associated with, like, ugly and undesirable. And, yeah, that's totally, we hear that all. I think I hear it all the time. I don't know if you guys also hear it.
Yeah, no, very true. Like, I don't know how many times I've been told, oh, you should try papaya soap to whiten your skin and yes. and don't go outside because you're going to get too dark. And it's like, I'm already dark. Like, I don't know what you want. And I think I'm beautiful. So what are you going to do about it? Yeah. Okay. So there's another comment here. Someone wants to know, shouldn't we say Chookies Lives Matter instead of Black Lives Matter?
Man, I don't know if you guys, my response to that has always been, I hope that we talk about the racism that the Chookies community, the FSM community experiences here, along with Black Lives Matter, right? We don't need to.
Yes. It shouldn't be like a fight against each other. It should be more geared towards fighting together instead of against each other, because we do experience, both sides experience the same or different type of racism, but we do experience racism. And to say instead, it's insinuating that we should just push aside the Black Lives Matter movement and just focus only on one issue when we should be focusing on all the issues that a lot of people are experiencing and the lives that are being lost, whether they are killed or whether their livelihoods are taken away because they get sentenced for a long time in jail for something that another person gets sentenced for half or not even a third of the time, or even just on probation or anything like that. So I really believe that we shouldn't pit these issues against each other, because that just creates more violence and more harm in the community. Just people who are.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. It's not either or, you know, it's not either you support this or you support that. There's an issue that we're all facing, and we need to address every issue. It's not like we could just push one to the side. You know, just because we say Black Lives Matter doesn't mean Chookies Lives don't matter. You know, it doesn't mean Tomorrow Lives don't matter. It just means that this is our focus right now. And truly, I would love to see a future podcast possibly with other with the Chookies community, maybe the Chookies community could come on to Fanatsu and have this conversation, you know, because there is an issue with that.
Yes, there is a huge issue. And I think that that is something that, you know, I'm glad that people are recognizing right now. Are we still online? Can you guys hear me?
Yes, sorry. Okay, so another question that was posed is, so this person attended one of the BLM protests. I'm not sure if it was yours, Talisa, or someone else's. But they said that
I think it was mine.
Hopefully.
Sorry.
They felt amazed to be in the space and was so excited to see the support. And then she saw that there was so much hate and ignorance online about it. You know, there was a lot of backlash, right? And she wants to know how we can fight that, right? What is our response to the backlash?
For the backlash, honestly, what I've been doing, because I have been seeing it a lot, is I just try to educate through what I know and what I think and what I've seen. And there's always going to be the comments that are so negative and derogatory. And what I think the most I can do is just spread awareness and spread through what I know, my education. And I do sometimes just scroll past it because I personally don't want to feel that type of ignorance. I already tried my best with doing that in a particular way, but I just think I know that I shouldn't stop what I'm doing. I shouldn't let some comments weigh me down or tie me down or not make me want to be motivated to carry on with this movement.
Mm-hmm. Right. I agree with that. And, you know, I think I told Nicole I was so grateful for this space, right? Because, yeah, a lot of what we're hearing in the local community, there's a lot of negativity. But then I always try to focus on the people who, you know, the people who are standing in solidarity with us. And what you said, Talisa, like trying to educate, but only having those conversations with people who are open to learning, right? Because that's another thing. Sometimes people enter those conversations with the sole intent of just tearing you down or like not even hearing what you're trying to say. And so I think it's so important to reserve your energy for the people who are willing to listen or who are wanting to educate themselves.
Yes. Usually with ignorant comments like that, I say what I feel like I need to say, and if they just keep on going on, I really don't exert my energy on that because I feel like I have better things to do than to try and educate someone who doesn't want to understand or even listen to what is trying to be said.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I feel like you said, conserve our energy and educate those who are open to be educated, and try not to waste your time, you know, too much time on those who are just completely blocking you out and not giving a crap what you say. This actually perfectly leads into the next question. A commenter said, I don't know how to talk about my Manumku about any of this. They are sometimes so racist, and I don't think they even understand how or why they hate or what it does. So I guess this person was trying to talk to their grandpa, and the grandpa really hates the protests and is very against the protests. And, you know, I talked to Kiana about this like a couple of days ago, and how it's so hard to speak to our Manumku, especially from the Chamorro perspective, you know, point of view inside us. It's like, you're so disattentive, you're so disrespectful if you disagree with your Manumku, or if you go against anything they're saying, or you know, argue with them, or, you know, try and educate them. It's like you're fighting something deep inside yourself that's telling you not to open your mouth because they're old, you know, they're your elders. And so it's a very difficult, you know, we recognize it's a very difficult position to be in, to have to try and educate our elders or the Manumku about why things are the way they are and why we protest and why some of the things that they say and do are so racist.
Right. Man, it took me like 18 years or like 19 years to get my grandma to tell me like it's okay to be Black. And that was like through a lot of like little conversations, right? Because like you said, not wanting to be disrespectful, knowing like why the Mnumku think the way that they do, right? The time period that they came up in and the kind of things that they were hearing about Black people. Yeah, so I don't know how to answer that question. That's a tough one.
That is a really tough one because I don't know what to say either. Thankfully, the Mnumku in my family who I've come across with what I'm trying to do and with the movement and everything, they've been really supportive of this because they too do have, like I said, I have a lot of Black and Chamorro cousins and aunties and relatives and stuff. So they're very supportive of this movement, but I don't know how I can advise anybody else who do have Mnumku who are really against it because I haven't experienced it. So I don't know how I would deal with it either, honestly.
I think I think the best way, at least for me, the best way that I've gone about it is just being very upfront, but being very respectful, you know, at the same time, like, so-and-so, I want you to know that I love you and that I respect you and everything, but I feel like your comments or what you say is inappropriate or is, you know, not right or something along those lines. And then, you know, take baby steps, you know, and be very open to having a conversation, right? Don't try and shut them down. Don't try and block them out or don't try and put them in their place or, you know, prove them wrong. Just try your best to educate them, right? That's the best way I can think of doing this, right? Is just try your best to educate them and hopefully they see the light. I don't know. So our next question, how do you think decolonization on Guahan is tied to addressing how anti-Blackness works on Guahan? That's a heavy question.
That is a heavy question. Does someone want to take it?
I'm really thinking about it too.
I feel like we should come back to this question because it's a really heavy question and it's an important topic. And it definitely is, you know, there is a connection that we can form, but I feel like we would need to articulate. So we'll come back to that one. What artists or musicians can we expose ourselves to help up or our consciousness about BLM? So if you go to, if you have Spotify, if you
or go Apple to Spotify, music too.
You can search up Black Lives Matter. And there's a whole playlist of very woke songs, of really, really good songs that kind of take you on a journey. One of my friends had put me onto this playlist, right? And she explained, she was like, it literally takes you through the whole journey of what it's like to be Black and to be in the Black Lives Matter movement. So I highly suggest checking that out on Spotify. It's called Black Lives Matter. You just search it up and it's I think it's like an orange background with a black fist, but it's great. I highly recommend that that playlist. Anything extra from you guys?
They also have podcasts on Spotify as well. So I know there's some with Angela Davis and it just talks about her experience moving from the U.S. and then to Europe and experiencing racism in Europe and then moving back to the U.S. and all the stuff like that. So there is a lot with ties to music and art and everything in Spotify and on Apple Music too, like I mentioned earlier. So that's what I'd like to add on.
Yeah, Code Switch is a really good podcast to listen to at this time on Spotify. That's it.
I have to add. I feel like code switching is such a heavy, like I could talk for like an hour about just code switching. Code switching is, it's so amazing. Like I was doing code switching just this morning when I was talking to relatives and then got on the phone to talk to one of my students' parents. It's like, oh, real quick, you know? Okay, so here's an interesting question that... It's so interesting. Can someone support Black Lives Matter and Trump at the same time? What do you guys think?
I think there's some contradictories there.
Yeah, I think yes, but that person is probably not being very critical of their choices.
I feel like that's a great answer. Like, yes, but you're right. It's like, I think if you look deep into what your choices are and deep into why you support one or the other, it's kind of like, it's hard to justify supporting both. But if you can, let us know.
That kind of goes back to like the question about decolonization and BLM, right? Not anti-Black or same thing, but there are people who support BLM or who are being really outspoken about it, but don't see that connection with decolonization or, right, the indigenous sovereignty. So you can be both on both sides, but it's just, yeah, contradictory.
I feel like almost it would tear you apart. like I feel like it would be like two halves of yourself that are really trying to pull you in opposite directions. So this person wants to know if you see a connection between people on Guam being very religious and very against Black Lives Matter. In their mind, the people who are really against it seem to also be very pro the church. I was talking to one of my Black friends, right, who had moved to the island, and we were talking about how religion is like very heavily responsible for slavery and, you know, and racism in the world, right, and how it like religion backed the triangular trade and religion backed the slave trade. And like back in that time in, you know, in the 1600s and everything, it was very heavily, you know, religion was very heavily racist back then. So what do you guys think now? Do you think there's a tie between being religious and being against the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think there's some tie, but I don't have enough knowledge on the religion side or experience either to exactly pinpoint what could be there.
I think a lot of where the religion comes in being against the movement is towards the violence, maybe, from what I've seen, from what I've experienced, is that the violence is what a lot of religious people are going against and saying that that's why we need to stop the protests, is because there's so much violence happening, you know, the riots and everything that is going on. Mm-hmm. I feel that that's where I see, personally, in my life, that's where I see a lot of people being against through the religious aspect, you know, is that they're people of God and they don't believe in violence. But I don't really know, like Talisa said, I'm not really 100% sure how religion plays into it. But that's an interesting interesting topic to think about. So, people keep commenting, all lives matter. So, any response to all lives matter?
I think we can safely ignore that and move on, since we've already kind of...
Yeah. How? Yeah.
It's just, you know, of course, all lives matter. That's why, that's the whole point of Black Lives Matter, is that Black lives matter and nobody gives a shit.
That's the truth. Okay.
So, ooh, interesting. So this person says they're half Micronesian and half Black, and they want to know whose message we should listen to more in these times, MLK or Malcolm X?
And that goes back to, like, this question of violence, right? Yeah, I definitely think the answer is both. For those who don't know, like, that divide is, like, on one side, violent action versus nonviolent action, right?
They're both fighting for the same thing. It's just in different ways.
Right. And my thing has always been, like, you know, there's no... Everyone is going, that's the way that people are doing things now. Like, not everybody is going to be out on the streets, but maybe they're having conversations. Maybe they're trying to teach people. Maybe they're writing. Maybe they're making music. Like, whatever your form of activism is, like, you do, you know, you do you. That's usually my.
Yes, definitely. I feel like, in the very beginning, I was kind of like, oh my God, why are they rioting? And then I kind of, of course I did my research and I was kind of like getting really absorbed in everything that's been happening. And I, you know, with the help of my friends, kind of came to the realization, like, who are we, who is anybody to tell somebody else how to grieve? Who is anybody to tell somebody else how to protest, you know? And I feel like, yeah, we should definitely look at both MLK and Malcolm X. They weren't enemies. You know, a lot of people are like, oh no, they hated each other. They didn't hate each other. They were both fighting for the same purpose, the same movement, right? And even though MLK was very, you know, anti-violence, he did recognize, you know, he was quoted saying that a riot is a language of the unheard. And how long are we going to be peacefully silent and peacefully patient waiting? Are we going to wait another 400 years before we are recognized as actual human beings? You know, So definitely look at both MLK and Malcolm X. I don't think it's an either or.
Right. I agree.
So, this next question is, does the panel think it'll make a difference if Biden wins? A lot of people have been saying no.
A difference in,
like, I guess in the movement.
Oh, yeah, I don't think. If Biden wins presidency, I think people will still continue fighting for the Black Lives Matter movement and to keep advocating for those who are not able to be heard. But since, yeah.
I don't think one man can change the tide. I think that it is a global movement that we all need to partake in order to make an actual difference. Even if you're the president of the United States, one man can't change the world. You know, it has to be a movement, you know. We all have to be a part of it. I feel like that's the best answer I can come up with. So, So anti-blackness is taught in schools, right? This is what someone else is saying. How can we unlearn hateful lessons? I don't know. I feel like you have to educate yourself.
Yes.
You know, you have to really look inside yourself, right? And then look at the world. How do you, like, the thing that always comes back to me and the thing I always say to my students is, how do you want to be treated? And then treat other people that way. You know, don't, if you don't want to be treated like dirt, if you don't want to be treated as less than a human being, why would you treat anybody else like that? You know, so I guess that's like the biggest thing I can think of is like, how do you want to be treated? Treat other people that way.
Yes. And I think it's really important. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Salisa.
I think it's important to note that although school and education, we should take it seriously and we should value what we learn. It's also important to look for yourself and try and educate yourself, because a lot of the U.S. history was whitewashed to make it look a certain way, like with Columbus discovering the new land and everything like that. It looked very nice and rainbows and butterflies, but if you really do look back, you see the genocide of all the Native Americans and the land that was taken from them and everything like that. So I do believe that to unlearn what is being taught, to just really educate yourselves with today's history and see how different it is from what we learned in school.
Right.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, I'm a history teacher, and so it's so hard to see these things in textbooks or, you know, in videos that are very Eurocentric or very white-centered, you know, that don't take into account the other perspectives of, you know, the other people in play in this story. So I always try to push my students to look past what's in the book, right? Look into other sources, right? Make sure you know you have more than one resource or one source of information. Double check your facts, because you know, sometimes it's not going to be Islander centered. It's not going to be Afro centered. It's not going to be Indigenous centered. You know, most of what's out in the world and most of the information provided to children these days is very Eurocentric, you know, and I always try and like, let them know, like, this is what the white people say. This is what really happened. They don't always sync up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kiana, did you have a comment for that?
I kind of wanted to answer like the next question, which kind of ties into that.
Oh yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so somebody asked the question, what do we remember learning about African American history from our history teachers here on Guam? And I'm gonna say mostly nothing until maybe I was 11th grade, until I was junior in high school. Before that, in my element, I went to Ordot Chalampago Elementary School, and my mom had to actually come to the school and have a meeting with my teacher and ask her why I wasn't being taught anything about Black history during Black History Month, right? So it actually took her having to go there and ask that question before they even considered giving us a lesson. And then it was the very basic, the very basic lesson. And that was probably the only lesson I had all the way up until I was in my junior year of high school.
I agree. I think we went to school together our whole lives.
Oh really?
I went to elementary school there, but I remember vaguely in sixth grade having a lesson on the slave trade And I remember watching a video about slaves coming from Africa to the U.S. And like really all I remember that stuck in my head was that the teacher covered the screen during a nude part. And then like everything else kind of just like, it didn't stick. There was no impact, you know. And I'm not blaming the teacher per se, but I feel like a lot of the times Black history or African American history is very pushed to the side. You know, it's not addressed. It's very American centered, white American centered. Yes.
And that same thing is true for Chamorro history and Indigenous history and every other history that's not white history. So
I remember I would say sixth grade or seventh grade, what I remember, which is I guess I only remember because it was so disheartening to me, is that when the slaves per se were being brought to America, what I remember is that to get away from being sold and being turned into sex slaves or stuff like that, they would jump off the ships all chained up and just kill themselves basically just to escape that type of life. But that's basically all I remember. And I know that when we did talk about the slave trade and everything like that in school, obviously we were young and all my classmates would just look at me because I was the only Black person in class, and they would just, I guess, be surprised about seeing similarities between me and the people who were pictured in the textbooks as slaves as well. So that's my memory from learning about African-American or African history in school.
I agree. It's very not... it's very overlooked, right? Our history is very overlooked. So we're about to end our podcast here. We have 9 minutes left. But I wanted to address this last question because I thought it was a pretty good question. And this person says, "Hi, ladies. Can you please share what steps or ways you took to learn about and embrace your African heritage? And then how were you able to embrace and unify your Chamorro ancestry or identity?" I guess, how were you able to bring the two together? Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You know, Nicole, go for it. I spoke first last time.
Okay, Kiana, do you want to go?
Okay, I'll spare you guys and I'll go. So for me, I think, you know, I mentioned in my household, I was always encouraged to kind of embrace both of my heritages. And part of that was that I always had positive, like, representations of Black people in my household. I was always listening to Black music, watching Black film growing up. When I became older and I was brave enough to start reading the books that I wasn't brave enough to read when I was a teenager, I started reading that. Books has probably been like the thing that's connected me the most, right? That's my love language. And then in terms of my Chamorro identity, I didn't have to do any hard work for that, right? Because I came up in a Chamorro community. And for me, it was always, even though I was kind of experiencing a lot of anti-Black racism, I knew that both parts of my identity, like that there was harmony there. Just because of those histories, right? Like, I can see the connections between both of my histories. And so for me, when we talk about Black Lives Matter, when we talk about Chamorro history and our quest for sovereignty, like that's the same fight, you know, in my head. So that's how I've kind of unified both of those sides. And then I do want to mention one thing. I am working right now on a project on Black Chamorro narratives. So that's the way that I'm, you know, that's the work that I've been doing these past 2 years. And that plays into that, how do I unify both of those sides? Because I think I'm not the only one who sees, you know, the ways that the Black Chamorro experience is really beautiful here.
Talisa, do you want to go?
Sure. The way I unify my Chamorro and my Black side or heritage is, I guess, accepting and admiring that I do come from two groups of oppressed people, and just to be using my voice and to be trying to educate other people and to be the one to try and make a change, it feels very powerful, actually, because of everything that both sides, Black and Chamorros, have gone through. And being a product of both of these oppressed people is like, it's like empowering, really, trying to make a difference in the everyday life. But yeah, that's basically how I unify both of them, just acknowledging that these people were beaten down and killed and everything on both sides, and to be a person who is speaking out against it now and trying my best to make a change, even if it's smaller changes or larger changes, everything's a chain reaction. That's how I unify both sides.
That's definitely like the best. I feel like it's a great way to, you know, to pull it both together and recognize that the Black community and the Chamorro community aren't exactly too different, especially history wise. You know, there was definitely a lot of oppression on both sides, right? I feel like for me, because I wasn't raised Black, to say, you know, like I was raised very Chamorro, the Black side of me wasn't, I wouldn't say ignored, but it was pushed to the side, you know. I wasn't raised to be like, yeah, I'm Black. It wasn't something that was hidden or oppressed or like to be ashamed of, but just not something that was necessarily nurtured, right? So I had to go, like, once I was old enough to start asking these questions, I started to explore, you know, started to read books, watch movies, and get really absorbed into the culture and, you know, find my place in the culture. And the Chamorro side of me was just always there. So I kind of just had to figure out how I fit into both, I guess, or how both fit into me, more to say.
Right.
Okay, so it's 2:57 now. We're coming to the end of our podcast. I think we discussed a lot of great things, and hopefully we answered most of your questions. If we didn't get to it, sorry, but thank you for joining us on this journey, and possibly maybe we'll have another podcast soon. So please stay tuned, and we will see you next time. Bye.
Thank you.
This was awesome.